Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. President Bush justified his 2003 invasion of Iraq by declaring in the run-up to the war that Iraq threatened to attack the United States with weapons of mass destruction. However, no such weapons were ever found. And the war, which has cost thousands of American and Iraqi lives, continues to this day. In launching the war against Iraq, did President Bush commit an error of judgment, or did he commit murder? Please stay tuned for the next edition of History Counts, the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. We're very fortunate to have as our guest today attorney Vincent Bugliosi, author of The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Vincent Bugliosi has practiced law for over 40 years, many of them as a prosecutor. In his career at the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, he successfully prosecuted 105 out of 106 felony jury trials, including 21 murder convictions without a single loss. His most famous trial, the Charles Manson case, became the basis of his true crime classic, Helter Skelter, which was the biggest-selling true crime book in publishing history. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Bugliosi.
Well, thanks, Ken, for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Under your proposed prosecution of George W. Bush,
right,
what act or acts constitute murder, and who were the victims?
In the book, I present evidence that proves beyond all reasonable doubt that George Bush took this nation, Ken, to war on a lie under false pretenses, and therefore under the law, he's guilty of all the deaths of American soldiers. He's guilty of murder for the deaths of all American soldiers that have died so far in the Iraq War, which is over 4,000. So the victims are the American soldiers. Now, let's not forget about the over 100,000 innocent Iraqi men, women, children, and babies who have died horrible, violent deaths because of George Bush's war. He's guilty of those murders, too, but I was unable to establish jurisdiction here in America to prosecute him for those murders of Iraqi civilians. But I was able to establish jurisdiction here in America to prosecute him for the deaths of the over 4,000 American soldiers. When we're talking about murder, the elements are it's an unlawful killing with malice aforethought. That's the state of mind required. You have to keep in mind that the criminality, that is the unlawfulness of an act, is solely dependent on the state of mind of the actor at the time he engaged in the act. So here we have to focus in on two states of mind. Malice aforethought is either express malice, where there's an intent to kill. In this situation, Bush never had an intent to kill in the popular sense of the word. But the intent to kill would be satisfied because he did an act, invading Iraq, which he absolutely knew would result in the deaths of American soldiers, unless he wanted to argue, and I think he finds sound rather silly arguing it, that he was contemplating a war without casualties. Now that's express malice, where there's an intent to kill, but then there's implied malice aforethought, which does not require an intent to kill. Only an intent to do an inherently dangerous act, which certainly going to war is, with reckless disregard for the consequences and indifference to human life. So at a minimum here, we have implied malice. But neither of these two states of mind that I just mentioned, express malice or implied malice, would be criminal if Bush, at the time he engaged in his act, did so under lawful circumstances, if there was some legal defense. So really the main, if there's some legal justification for what he did. So really the main issue at the trial, if Bush were ever prosecuted, would be whether or not he took this nation to war, as he always claimed, in self-defense, his so-called preemptive strike. Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, so he was an imminent threat to the security of this country, so we had to strike first in self-defense. If he could prove at the trial, he doesn't have the burden of proof, but he certainly would offer proof. The prosecution would have the burden of proving the opposite, that Bush did not take this nation to war in self-defense. But if the evidence of the trial emerged that Bush acted in self-defense, then the killings in Iraq of American soldiers would be legally justifiable. But if the prosecutor could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Bush did not take the nation to war in self-defense, but under false pretenses, then all of the killings of American soldiers in Iraq would become unlawful killings, and therefore murder. So the key issue, as I see it at the trial, would be whether or not Bush took this nation to war in self-defense.
You use the term vicarious liability. What does that mean?
Vicarious liability is a situation where even though you don't commit the act, you're guilty of it. Typically, in a criminal case, conspirators are guilty under the vicarious liability theory. For instance, I convicted Manson, Charles Manson, of the 7th-8 LaBianca murders, even though he didn't participate in the murders, wasn't even present at the murder scene. But the vicarious liability rule holds that each member of a conspiracy is criminally responsible for all crimes committed by his co-conspirators to further the object of the conspiracy. Now, another type of vicarious liability is the innocent agent doctrine, which is applicable here, where you have a situation where someone deliberately sets in motion a chain of events which he knows, absolutely knows, will cause, that's the key word, will cause a third-party innocent agent to commit an act, here the killing of American soldiers by Iraqis. The person that sets in motion that chain of events is responsible for that act, even though he did not commit the act himself. So here George Bush, in invading Iraq, knew that he would be causing Iraqis, either in self-defense or to repel an invader, to fight back. And in fighting back, Bush knew that American soldiers would lose their lives, unless, as I indicated, he argues that he was contemplating a war without casualties. So that's the innocent agent doctrine. Federally, it's even codified under federal law, Title 18, Section 2, Subdivision B, which in a sense, in effect, holds that if someone causes an act to be done, which if he committed it himself, he'd be guilty, he's still guilty if he causes someone else to do it. Now, he doesn't have to want the innocent agent to commit the act. All that has to be shown is that he caused them to. And certainly Bush, in invading Iraq, caused Iraqis to fight back, and therefore he's responsible for their act. They're innocent agents.
Where would such an action be brought, and what would be the basis for the jurisdiction?
I've established jurisdiction for Bush to be prosecuted for murder as well as conspiracy to commit murder on a federal and state level. Federally, there's really only one prosecutor, the Attorney General in Washington, D.C., operating through his Department of Justice. There are 93 U.S. attorneys around the country. It's not realistic to believe that they would bring an action against Bush without the consent of their boss in Washington, D.C. first. And that's why I feel that realistically, on a federal level, we're only talking about one prosecutor, the Attorney General in Washington, D.C. But on a state level, I've established jurisdiction for the Attorney General in each of the 50 states, plus the approximately 2,700 district attorneys in counties within those states, to prosecute Bush for the murder of any soldier or soldiers from their state or county who died fighting George Bush's war in Iraq. Now, the main argument that people will automatically use is the territorial jurisdiction argument that a state, for instance, only has jurisdiction, if this was going to be a state prosecution, to prosecute for crimes committed within the territorial jurisdiction of that state. I'm in California now. If a crime is committed in Kansas, California does not have a jurisdiction. Now, here we have the killings in Iraq, so how could California or Kansas or Texas prosecute Bush? And the reason is they could is that there's a well-recognized exception to the rule of territorial jurisdiction. It's called the effects, E-F-F-E-C-T-S, the effects doctrine, which holds that if an act or a crime is committed outside of a state, but it has a very harmful, deleterious effect upon the citizens of the state, then that state has jurisdiction. So the act was committed in Iraq, but there's no question that when you lose citizens of the state, they end up dying. I don't think there's anything more serious than death that I know of. That state has jurisdiction. And the harmful effects are not only the deaths of the American soldiers from a given state, but, you know, the war has cost us $1 trillion so far, close to $1 trillion, and the states all share in that economic burden. We've also lost respect around the world for invading a sovereign nation, Iraq, without any provocation. In the book, I set forth quite a few cases on a state and federal level applying the effects doctrine. And the effects doctrine has been applied to situations infinitely less significant than causing the deaths of civilians within the state or country.
Well, now if we could move on to the evidence. You cite the National Intelligence Estimate of October 1, 2002 to support the case. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. I testified before the House Judiciary Committee on July 25th, and I had the documents in front of me, and I told the Judiciary Committee that when Bush, that I had documentary evidence that when Bush told the nation on the evening of October 7th, 2002, that Hussein was an imminent threat to security of this country, he was telling millions of unsuspecting Americans the exact opposite of what his own CIA had told him just 6 days earlier in a classified top secret report of October the 1st, that Hussein was not an imminent threat to the security of this country, that he'd only be a threat if he feared an imminent attack on him by us. In other words, he'd only be a threat if he was forced to fight in self-defense. Now, we found out later that under no circumstances would he be a threat, because at the time, it was believed he had weapons of mass destruction, but it was learned later, of course, that he destroyed all of his weapons in 1991 at the time of the Persian, at the end of the Persian Gulf War. But this is pretty serious, telling the nation that Hussein's an imminent threat when 16 U.S. intelligence agencies headed by the CIA have told you that he's not an imminent threat. But it gets worse. On October the 4th, the Bush administration put out an unclassified summary version of the top-secret classified report of October the 1st, 3 days earlier. And this unclassified version came to be known as the White Paper. And in this White Paper, the conclusion of U.S. intelligence that Hussein was not an imminent threat to the security of this country was completely deleted. Every single one of those words were taken out. So Congress and the American people never saw any of that. And I told the Judiciary Committee, I said, since we're dealing here with a matter of war and peace, and with the safety and lives of millions of human beings at that time hanging in the balance, and with Congress about to vote in just 7 days, October 11th, on whether to authorize George Bush to go to war, what could possibly be worse and more criminal than Bush and his people deliberately keeping this all-important conclusion from Congress and the American people? This is very strong circumstantial evidence that Bush and his people knowingly and deliberately took this nation to war under false pretenses.
You also refer to a CIA letter of 7 October 2002 from George Tenet's deputy director, John McLaughlin, to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Could you talk about that?
Well, he was just saying the same thing, that Hussein was not an imminent threat to the security of this country. But the American people and the great bulk of Congress were under the impression that he was an imminent threat.
Is there any doubt that President Bush knew the contents of this letter or the NIE report?
Well, that's a very good question. Someone could argue, you know, Mr. Bugliosi, you talk about the fact of how lazy he is, this guy, 908 days away from the Oval Office on vacation and other retreat places as of January the 1st, 2008, far more than any other president in American history. I also point out in the book he didn't read memorandums, but he did read summaries of them. The centerpiece of their going to war, the Bush administration said, was this, I think it was a 91-page document of October the 1st. In that 91-page document, Bush may not have read it, but the chances are he read the 8-page summary, because this is the most important summary that they relied upon in going to war. But let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that he didn't even read those 8 pages. And here I'm prosecuting for murder. As they say in the law, when you're a trial lawyer, you ask the question, where does that go? Where does it go? Well, here's where it goes. Condoleezza Rice is on record as saying that she read that report, cover to cover, the 91-page report, a couple of times. So certainly she knew about it. And then you have to draw the inference, if Bush did not read it, that not only didn't he read it, but Condoleezza Rice didn't even tell him of this all important conclusion of U.S. intelligence. The reason that doesn't go anywhere is that by all accounts, Condoleezza Rice was, I don't know if I use the word subservient, but just totally committed to being loyal to the President of the United States. So if we take that route, then here's what we're left with. We're left with the conclusion that the real villain here is not George Bush, but, you ready? Condoleezza Rice. That she's the one that decided to invade Iraq without provocation, and her desire to invade Iraq was so great that she decided not only to lie to the American people, take them to war under false pretenses, but she also decided to lie to her own boss, George Bush. I can tell you, Ken, that no one would buy that argument. So that's where that goes in the direction of it. If we were to prosecute them, let her take the stand if she wants to. She wants to ensure the death penalty for herself by saying, I lied to the president. That's not going to happen.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Another theme in the book is that Saddam Hussein was tied to 9/11 by President Bush. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, Bush told two main lies here. One, that Hussein was an imminent threat to security of this country, and he knew he was not. We can get into the Manning memo, which were words coming out of his own mouth showing it. The second lie is when he told the nation by unmistakable innuendo that Hussein was involved in 9/11, and he absolutely knew that Hussein was not involved in 9/11. Now, he did this in two ways. Let me first go back and tell you that an open-ended poll right after 9/11 showed that only 3% of the American people thought Hussein and Iraq were involved in 9/11. Yet, within a matter of months, it was approaching 70%. Now, if it wasn't Bush and his people who were responsible for this suddenly widespread conclusion, then who was it? As I say in the book, you, me, Danny DeVito. Obviously, it was George Bush and his people. And he convinced the American public that Hussein was involved in 9/11 basically in two ways. One, he was constantly telling the public what an urgent threat, imminent threat, that Hussein posed to this nation. And in the very same breath sometimes the same sentence, but certainly within the same paragraph, the same page, the speech, he would talk about 9/11. So the juxtaposition of constantly saying that Hussein was a threat and 9/11 caused the American people, you know, who are interested in other things, you know, their own economic survival, the Dodgers or Yankees or whatever they're doing, they're not going to sit there and parse his words. All they heard was Hussein, a threat, and 9/11. And it's understandable. They came to the conclusion that Hussein must have been involved in 9/11. And then Bush went beyond that by just flat out deliberately lying. Everyone knew that Al-Qaeda was involved. So the Bush administration knew, and they were correct in making this assumption, that if Bush could connect Hussein with Al-Qaeda, the American people would conclude that he must have been involved in 9/11.
You quote a 25 September 2002 speech where President Bush said, quote, "You can't distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Saddam when you talk about the war and terror. They work in concert."
Yeah, you can't distinguish the two when you talk about them. And also, he made statements like Iraq had trained Al-Qaeda in bomb-making and the use of deadly poisons and gases. And he also said that Hussein had ties with Al-Qaeda. So when you hear stuff like that, the American people, they knew Al-Qaeda was involved. I mean, bin Laden on TV, a video, admitting guilt. And then you hear Bush saying that Hussein's involved with Al-Qaeda. Again, the American people drew the inference that Hussein must have been involved in 9/11. And 90% of the American troops in Iraq, as late as August of 2006, thought that they were going over there because it was payback time to fight the Hussein and the Iraqi people for being responsible, partially behind 9/11. I was in Vermont recently, and I spoke in a classroom, and one of the soldiers there, an Iraq veteran, and he said, yeah, we all, it was just assumed that we were getting even for 9/11. He said, when you enter the base, all the bases in Iraq, you see these two twin columns next to each other with words to the effect, we cannot forget, you know.
In his war speech, he says, quote, "We will meet that threat now." This is on March 19th, 2003. "We will meet that threat now so that we do not have to meet it later with armies of firefighters and police and doctors on the streets of our cities,"
yeah,
end quote.
Yeah, he led the American people to believe Hussein was not involved in 9/11, and every single U.S. intelligence agency came to the conclusion that Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Every federal investigation, 9/11 Commission, Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, said there's not one speck of evidence showing any umbilical cord between Hussein and 9/11.
And we can assume that information did make its way to the president?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Well, can you talk about the Manning memo, which is January 31st, 2003?
The Manning memo is the, like you said, the meeting between Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair on January 31st, 2003 in the Oval Office for 2 hours with six of their top aides, including Blair's chief foreign policy advisor, David Manning. After the meeting, Manning prepared a five-page memo stamped extremely sensitive in which he summarized what was said at the meeting. And among other things, he said that both were concerned about the failure of UN inspectors to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But then he says Bush, because of it, started talking about three possible ways to, quote, provoke a confrontation, unquote, with Hussein, one of which Bush said was to, quote, fly U-2 reconnaissance aircraft over Iraq, painted, obviously falsely, in United Nations colors. And Bush said if Hussein fires upon them, they'll be in violation of UN resolutions, and that would justify our going to war. So here we have Bush telling the nation, telling the world, that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country. But behind closed doors, this small man was talking about how to provoke Hussein into a war. Now, Ken, by definition, if Bush genuinely and honestly believed that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, which is what he told the American people was the main reason for going to war, the thought of trying to provoke Hussein into a war would never, ever have entered his mind. So here we have words from Bush's own mouth that I think prove that he knew he was lying when he told the nation that Hussein was an imminent threat.
On February 5th, at the famous 2003, the famous UN speech, Secretary of State Powell said, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein has bioweapons and the capability to rapidly produce many more, that he has chemical weapons, and he remains determined to acquire nuclear weapons. Can President Bush be held accountable for what Secretary Powell said at the UN?
No, the issue is not weapons of mass destruction, and yet the entire country thinks it is. And I don't say in the book that Bush and his people lied over weapons of mass destruction. They did in one particular area, but that's not the main reason. That's not the main way he lied. He lied when he said that Hussein was an imminent threat. I could not prosecute Bush for murder claiming that he lied about weapons of mass destruction. Why? Because these 16 U.S. intelligence agencies that I told you earlier had said that Hussein was not an imminent threat. These same 16 thought that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. But having weapons of mass destruction and being an imminent threat are two different things. It's a non sequitur that just because you have weapons of mass destruction, you're an imminent threat. As I told the House Judiciary Committee, I said if that were the issue, whether you or not you had weapons of mass destruction, then we'd be involved in a war with Pakistan. They have weapons of mass destruction. China, Russia, Britain, France, Germany. Why aren't we going to war with them? The only issue, there aren't two or three issues here. There's only one issue, and that's whether or not a nation that has weapons of mass destruction is an imminent threat to the security of this country. And just because you have weapons of mass destruction, it turns out he didn't, but U.S. intelligence thought he did, does not mean that you're an imminent threat. Hussein was not an imminent threat, and I can summarize it in just one sentence, and there's no way to get around this. Hussein wanted to live. And when you want to live, you do not attack the United States of America or help anyone else do so. It's as simple as that. But you see, the Hans-Blix thing, though, is pretty important because Blix, after 731 inspections, as you know, found no weapons of mass destruction. But here's the important point. On March the 5th, 2003, Blix testified before the United Nations Security Council that he was getting, this is important because it goes to the state of mind of Bush, and we're talking about a crime here. He told the Security Council that he was getting, quote, proactive cooperation from Hussein. And he also said this, we are able to perform professional no-notice inspections all over Iraq. I'll repeat, we are able to perform professional no-notice inspections all over Iraq. But he said to confirm whether or not Hussein had weapons of mass destruction would not take years, would take months. He requested that time. Now, to anyone who wanted to avoid the horror and the bloodshed of a war in Iraq, Blix's words could hardly be better news. It would be extremely encouraging, and they wouldn't even dream of going to war in 2 weeks. What did Bush do? Well, we know what he did. He refused to grant Blix the extra time, booted Blix and his people out of Iraq, and went to war. Now, why did he do that? To me, the inference I draw, and I think it's the most reasonable one, is that in a paradoxical type of way, Blix and his inspectors became Bush's greatest adversaries, because Bush knew that if Blix and his people confirmed that there were no weapons of mass destruction, this would rob Bush of his main argument for war, which he wanted to fight at all costs. Now, if there's another reasonable interpretation to his refusing to give Blix a month or two more, I don't know what that interpretation would be.
What does a prosecutor have to show to a grand jury to obtain an indictment?
All you have to show at the grand jury level is a reasonable suspicion of guilt. You do not have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And I have to find a prosecutor somewhere out there in the country who's courageous enough to step forward and say, hey, this is the United States of America. In America, no man's above the law. The evidence of Bush's guilt is clear, so I'm going to bring about justice, go after him, and bring about justice for the American people. 97% to 98% of the time, the grand jury does what the DA or state attorney general asked them to.
If George W. Bush were placed on trial for murder, what impact do you think it would have on future presidents?
You see, there are some noble reasons for bringing him to trial. We want to deter a future president from taking this nation to another war under false pretenses. That deterrence would be increased dramatically if they knew what happened to George Bush, that he was prosecuted and convicted of murder in an American courtroom. The other noble thing is that the rest of the world now has a negative view of us. I don't know about the Obama election. That may change things substantially, but for the first time ever in American history, the majority of people around the world after we invaded Iraq had a negative view of America. And I think that if we want America to become the great nation it once was, we can hardly do that without our first bringing those responsible for the war in Iraq to justice. But I have to tell you this, these noble things that I just mentioned about increasing the prestige around the world and deterring future presidents, that's a part of my motivation, but it's not the main part. The main part is not noble like that. It's simply bringing this guy to justice. I don't want this guy to get away with murder. I don't like to see anyone get away with murder, even one murder. So you can imagine the way I feel about George Bush getting away with probably a minimum, absolute minimum of 100,000 murders. Some people put the number in excess of 1 million.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Bugliosi. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been speaking with attorney Vincent Bugliosi about his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. While attorney Vincent Bugliosi's proposal for the prosecution of George W. Bush for illegally invading Iraq is based on U.S. murder statutes, a prosecution might also be argued on the basis of international law. Both the Nuremberg Principles, promulgated after World War II, and the United Nations Charter declare that the planning, preparation, and initiation of a war of aggression constitutes a crime against peace, unless it can be shown that the aggressor was acting in self-defense. Additionally, while Mr. Bugliosi did not address the issue of torture, this issue has been raised by many others, and torture is a grave breach of international law under the Geneva Conventions. In 2002, the International Criminal Court was established as a permanent criminal court to prosecute war crimes and has commenced prosecutions against former heads of state, including Yugoslavia's Slobodan Milosevic. While the United States, under Mr. Bush, has refused to join the International Criminal Court, a war crimes prosecution could be made in a court in the United States under international law by virtue of the U.S. War Crimes Act. This act, which was passed by Congress in 1996 and signed by President Bill Clinton, declares that a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions or any international convention relating to war is a crime under U.S. law. The U.S. War Crimes Act of 1996 applies to U.S. citizens, and the penalty may include life imprisonment or death. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.